If you want to see something a bit less tame than this evening's meeting, come to Istanbul in October and other cities in Turkey. However, let me say this, and I've said this before when I've talked to Armenians in the Bay Area of San Francisco. I don't say there is anything wrong at all in demanding the acknowledgement from the Turkish state of what their predecessors did to the Armenian Christians and the killing of 1.5 million Armenians. But it might be a good idea if Armenians were to list those honorable and brave Turks who risked their lives in 1915 to save Armenian lives. We know their names. Some of them are actually printed in the famous Blue Book, which the British government published before the end of the First World War. And indeed, individual Armenians who survived, most of whom are now dead, have told me in the past 30 years of individual Turks who risked their lives, as individual Europeans did, to save Jewish lives at the time of the Holocaust, to save Armenians. And to show you, I'll give you a very brief quotation from my own book at the end of this chapter to show you how Armenian thoughts are changing. I am actually in this section of the book going to the old people's, the Armenian old people's home in Beirut. Down the corridor, a very old man is lying on a bed. He is Harutyun Kebejian. He is holding in his left hand a Bible in Braille, and his right hand is fingering the embossed paper letters. He greets me with a smile, sightlessly. It is now the year 2000, and he is 93 years old, so he was 8 when he survived the Armenian Holocaust. His memory is as clear as his emotions, and this is what he said. We lived in Dortyol. My father was called Sarkis, and my mother was Mariam. There were 10 children, including me and my brothers and sisters. The Turks collected all the people with their donkeys and horses. We were to go to Aleppo and Ras El Ain, but they started killing us on the way. The Turks forced us to the Habor River, and by the time we got there, there was only my mother and my sister and me left. They told the women and the men to take off all their clothes. My sister was 18, and a man on a horse came and grabbed her and put her on his horse. He did this in front of us. It happened in front of my eyes. I was not blind then, and they started to beat my mother. As she begged them not to take my sister, the Turks beat her to death. I have always remembered that as she died, she screamed my name, Harutyun, Harutyun. Later, an Arab Bedouin took me to his home, and I stayed there for 3 years. The war was over, and then people came saying they were looking for Armenian orphans. I said I was Armenian, so they took me to Aleppo. There I caught a virus that affected my eyes. I was suddenly blind, and I was only 11 years old. Until I was 23, I was filled with rage because the Turks took my sister and beat my mother in front of my eyes until she died. But when I was 23, I felt this was not the right way to be a man. So I began to pray to God so he would see me. I was making peace with myself. Now I am ready to meet my God. I am at peace. Last year, when the big earthquake happened in Turkey, it killed so many Turks. And I prayed to God for those Turks. I prayed for those poor Turkish people. I wonder what the reaction will be when I read that section in Turkey, because I shall. But let me go back again, if I may, to the whole issue of how we respond to events in the Middle East. One of the key events which changed my life as a journalist came in 1982, when Israel's phalangist Christian militia allies massacred up to 1,700 Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila camps in Beirut, not far from my home. That is more than half the total dead of the World Trade Center Crimes Against Humanity of September the 11th, 2001. Yet at that time, nobody lit candles. Nobody said the world had changed forever. No presidents came and stood next to the mass grave, which for many years was allowed to rot as a football pitch for Lebanese Shiite children. I'm going to show you now the last little clip of the same film series, which involves Sabra Shatila and involves what actually generated in Lebanon, partly as a result and partly because of the occupation of Lebanon. I should say immediately, no, Israel was not responsible for September the 11th, 2001, and I'm sick of hearing people say that it was. They were Arabs who carried out those attacks, and I'm sure it was bin Laden. though I know this is a government of secrecy which rules you in this country, and there are many questions which you rightly want to know the answers to, and I as a journalist rightly would like to hear the answers to as well. But I would like to show you this small clip of film, again, to show you the environment from which the suicide killers of September the 11th came. And I should add that one of them, the man who flew the plane into the ground when he was very bravely tackled by the passengers in Pennsylvania, I got to know his family quite well in Lebanon. He was Lebanese. The father, not long ago, bought a new Mercedes car for his son, whom he's still expecting to come home, right? And it was quite clear, talking to the family, that this man, this is Ziad Jarrah I'm talking about, was very much affected as a boy by the siege of Beirut in 1982. And what he said to his sisters, and I have confirmed this with them, when he was taken out of the city to comparative safety in the town of Zahle in the Bekaa Valley, confirmed this. However, I'd just like to show this little clip of film to you to show you how suicide bombing began. Can we go ahead, Doug? I'll try and pull this back again if you can. Moment of truth coming up here. That year changed Lebanon forever. It changed us too, made our lives as journalists more dangerous. They were violent, terrible days. Journalists are witnesses to history, and I watched it all. Violence is political as well as physical. During those hot, frightening months, I watched Muslims die in their thousands, killed by the Israelis, by weaponry which was, for the most part, made in America. And if Israel was their enemy, was it so surprising that so many Muslims came to regard America as their enemy too? We watched them die in the hospitals, burned, crushed. We even saw babies who'd been killed by Israeli phosphorus shells. There's no doubt what horrified me most at the time. Massacres are difficult to forget when you've seen the corpses. At the end of the invasion, in the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila, Israel's allies slaughtered hundreds of Palestinians while the Israelis watched. My colleague Hanadi was out of Lebanon at the time, but for anyone who was there, the memories are as fresh as if the killings happened yesterday.
And then as I walked up here, the first thing I saw were horses, dead horses, behind, around where that white building is. And I thought to myself, why would anyone kill a horse? And we still hadn't seen anyone dead. And as we got just up here, maybe 20 yards more, we saw two women lying on the ground on their backs with their clothes torn, middle-aged women, and sort of things scattered around them. I don't know, I thought they were maybe teapots. Maybe they were brewing tea when the gunman came and shot them. And just beyond them, behind their heads, lying on the ground, was a baby that was dead with a bullet in its head. It was a while when we were in. It was quite a while before we realised that the Christian gunmen whom the Israelis had sent in were still in the camp. We heard shooting. So we all got very frightened there. And at one point, my two colleagues, Carsten and Lauren, they were somewhere over there. And I could hear them talking, but I didn't know where they were. And I was shouting, Carsten, Lauren! And you could still hear this shooting. And there was a kind of earth embankment, just like this one. The place has changed so much, new buildings, but there was an earth embankment like this. And I tried to climb over it. And I got on top, and when I was on it, it became all kind of spongy, and it moved up and down. And I realized it wasn't an earth embankment, it just had a covering of earth. And when I looked down, I saw a face, an elbow. They were all bodies, and somebody's stomach. And I just literally held my breath and jumped off the other side and went running down that road down there, because that's where I could hear my friends' voices. I was so frightened at the time. There were bodies scattered all over here, civilians, all of them. We never saw a gun, next to anybody here. And the big question we were asking ourselves when we came in here was answered when we stood here and looked up there. Because we were asking all the time, did the Israelis know what was going on? And I'd been in the camp maybe 2 hours before I got to this point, and I looked up at that building, and I saw the flash the sunlight catching binoculars to flash on the glass. And when I looked at it carefully, I saw Israeli soldiers on the top. And they were obviously looking at me, so they could see the bodies, so they knew what was happening.
I watched the American Marines arrive to protect the Palestinians, but Washington decided to support the Israeli-sponsored Lebanese government. American firepower was then directed at Muslim militias. The Muslims were bound to take their revenge. What happened next was to be a trauma in modern American history. Early on the morning of October the 23rd, 1983, a Muslim drove a truck bomb loaded with 2 tons of explosives into the US Marine base. The largest bomb since Hiroshima killed 241 Americans. The Americans regarded the suicide bombing as an act of mindless terrorism. The Muslim fundamentalists saw it as their greatest victory against Israel's closest ally. The most powerful army in the world had been struck down by a country without an army. Who were they, these young Americans? Innocent, naive, brave, no doubt, inevitably doomed, recording their tragic role in history without realizing their fate. The Americans had firepower. The Muslims who bombed them claimed they had God on their side. Technology versus God. An equation that was to have ferocious results in Lebanon.
A man was wearing jean fatigues and driving a yellow truck. And he says, as the man went by, he says, he always remembered that the guy was smiling.
A frightening new weapon had been introduced into the Middle East conflict, the car bomber, as dedicated as any kamikaze pilot, even allowing his comrades to film his own immolation.
Ladies and gentlemen, the history book, the history book. You know, when Napoleon undertook the French expedition to Egypt in the 18th century, he issued a manifesto to the people of Cairo saying he was going to free them from the pashas who hanged them when they exercised free speech. When General Sir Angus Maud invaded Iraq in 1917 and arrived with the British occupation army in Baghdad in that year, he issued a declaration in English and Arabic to the people of the Muhafazat, the governorate of Baghdad, a copy of which was peeled from the wall by Private Charles Dickens of the Cheshire Regiment, who later gave it to his daughter, and who, long after Dickens' death, sold it to me for $2,000, which is why it's now hanging beside my desk in my library while I was writing the book. And in that document, Angus Maud says to the people of Baghdad, "We come here not as conquerors, but as liberators, to free you from generations of tyranny." Shukran, thank you, shukran. I'm sure the Iraqis said. In 1920, an insurgency began against British rule. The first British officer was killed near a place called Abu Ghraib. Actually, the village was called Handari, and I know it very well because I went there in 2003 because it was the scene of the first killing of an American soldier by a roadside bomb. And while I was there, a man came up to me and said, "I'm the grandson of the man who killed Captain Townsend in 1920. And he was killed just over there, Mr. Robert." And in retaliation, in 1920, the British laid siege with artillery to a city called Fallujah. And we also laid siege in 1920 to a city called Najaf. And we demanded the handing over to us of a Shiite cleric called Badr, not Sadr. We got Badr, you didn't get Sadr. In 1920 as well, British military intelligence in Baghdad sent a telegram to the War Department in London, which I've seen, saying that terrorists were crossing the Iraqi border from, yes, Syria. You see, you knew what British intelligence said, even though you hadn't read the history book. Lloyd George, who was British Prime Minister in 1920, stood up in the House of Commons. The British occupation was very unpopular. It was costing a lot of money. Our soldiers were being killed. And Lloyd George said, if British troops are withdrawn from Iraq now in 1920, there will be spot on. That's what Lloyd George said. And you didn't know that until I began talking about Lloyd George. Isn't that amazing? But we didn't carry that in our back pocket history book, did we? Big problem. Why did we invade Iraq? Well, as I always say, if the national export of Iraq had been asparagus or carrots, the 82nd Airborne would not be in Mosul and the 3rd Infantry Division would not be in Baghdad, would it? But there is something else. South of Baghdad one day, August of last year, I was on Highway 8, horrible throat-cutting road, in investigating the death of a poor Red Cross driver who was shot dead by gunmen and talking to an Iraqi family on the highway whom I thought may have seen the people who did the murder. And suddenly the ground began to tremble under my feet, and up the road came the biggest bloody military convoy I've ever seen in my life, bigger than anything I saw of the Soviet army in Afghanistan. Just mile after mile of Abrams M1, A1 tanks, Bradley fighting armored vehicles, Humvees, tens of thousands of troops in trucks, all Americans, of course, rifles pointing out the side like porcupine quills, Apache helicopters swooping overhead, took an hour and a half to pass me. And sitting beside the road in the muck with the Iraqi family watching going by, I realized that it wasn't just about oil, that superpowers have an almost visceral need to project military strength. We can go to Baghdad, so we will go to Baghdad. We can get rid of Saddam, we'll get rid of him. And we'll take our armies across Sumeria and all the lands where civilization supposedly began, because we can do it. And we will do it, and we did do it. And that is one of the questions which keeps coming up in conversations I have with Iraqis in Iraq. Last August, an Iraqi friend of mine said to me, "Mr. Robert," in Baghdad, he said this. He said, "Mr. Robert, can you tell me something?" He said, "The American military in some form, you know, special forces, air bases, military divisions," he said, "the American military are now in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Turkey, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Algeria, special forces based near Taman Rasset in the southern Sahara now. They're in Kuwait, they're in Oman, they're in Yemen, they're in Bahrain, they're still in part of Saudi Arabia. Why are they there, Mr. Robert? And in Pakistan too? Why?" Donald Rumsfeld calls these lily pads, these little bases, right? But why? And in fact, this is a question we journalists haven't asked. You can go further north. Greenland, Britain, Germany, Yugoslavia, Bosnia, of course, Greece joins up with Turkey. From the ice cap down to the borders of Somalia, there is now an American Iron Curtain. Why? What's on the other side? China, Russia, India. What's it for? These are the questions that we as correspondents are not asking, and which we should ask, and which we have failed to ask. And we will continue to do so, because now the difficulties of reporting Iraq are so awful
that I, for the first time in my career as a foreign correspondent, am wondering if the risk is worth the story or if the story is worth the risk. I'm due to go back in 5 weeks to Iraq again, and I will, but I'm becoming seriously concerned that our ability to report when we are there is so constricted that it's not actually worth it. I mean, I invented, sadly for me, the phrase hotel journalism because many reporters now, and I don't blame them for this, they have families, they have editors who insist upon it, or security guards, ex-SAS men, ex-special forces with weapons who are all around the journalist and travel in cars bristling with guns with the journalist sitting inside. They don't leave their hotels. They use their mobiles to call the green zone where the Americans and British and the Iraqi government are to look for quotes. To which I say, well, you might as well live in Minnesota and use your mobile and call the green zone from there. Because, of course, the editors want Baghdad as the dateline. I don't mind if journalists stay in their hotels. What I do object to is that they do not tell their readers and their viewers and their listeners that they don't leave the hotel, thus giving the totally erroneous impression that they can go out and make a tour d'horizon and check the stories that 32 terrorists and only terrorists were killed in an airstrike in Tel Afar or whatever particular town there is. But what's the alternative? I practice what I now call mouse journalism. So does Patrick Coburn, my colleague, and other journalists in Baghdad. I give you an example. August, two suicide bombers at a bus station, usually used by Shiites. Someone wants a civil war in Iraq, even though the Iraqis don't. I get to the scene, street reporter, with my two Iraqi friends, a car, no weapons. Jump out of the car. I get one picture of a lady, a woman, burning next to a bus. I have 20 seconds of interview with an eyewitness, and then I have 40 or 50 Iraqis beating on the roof of my car in fury, so I jump in the car and I drive away. Mouse journalism. Okay, I can put together 500-600 words. A little bit of the color from the scene, I did see the eyewitness. But is it worth it? Is it really worth it anymore? And I really don't know. The Americans and British are very happy we can't move around and check things out. And nor does it seem to bother the embedded journalists. The fact that we actually use the word embedded tells you a lot about journalism today. The investigations going on into the alleged killing of innocent civilians by U.S. forces after U.S. troops had been killed by roadside bombs in two particular cases, one of them a Nazi-style execution, according to the evidence that's coming out, these were initiated by the military themselves. And they were right to do so, of course. Not by the journalists living with the military. They didn't discover this at all. So I'm not sure how we go on recording this tragedy which is in front of us, which is a tragedy for America and for Britain, but primarily, of course, for Iraqis. I'm not sure how we can constantly remind people of the costs of September 11th, 2001. Look at what happened only a few weeks ago when the Associated Press, in all fairness, I praise them for this, used the Freedom of Information Act to get up to 6,000 documents from Guantanamo. And here is how the Sydney Morning Herald, you can see I've now moved to Australia to launch my book, this is now March the 6th this year, carried the story. US papers tell Guantanamo inmate stories. But buried down in a little box was the real story. And remember, these are documents from the U.S. military authorities. These are not statements from prisoners. This involves a man called Feroz Ali Abbasi, a British citizen who has since been released and did say he was tortured in Guantanamo. But again, this document is U.S. military. He pleaded with the U.S. Air Force colonel in the drumhead court set up to know what the evidence was against him. Why was he in the court? He said, under international law, I have a right to know. And the U.S. Air Force colonel, who, in my view, should not have the right to wear his uniform, replied, I quote, Mr. Abbasi, your conduct is unacceptable, and this is your absolute final warning. I do not care about international law. I do not want to hear the words international law again. We are not concerned about international law. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to finish by what I've said before, I think even in this building, that I still think I have to end my reports with the words, watch out. But I will say one other thing, that September 11th, 2001, which were international crimes against humanity, has allowed the door to be opened on all the abuses and torture which we are now responsible for. And I tell you this, I will not let 19 Arab murderers change my world, and nor should you. Thank you for your patience in talking.
Thank you very much. I think Doug is going to take any questions down on paper. And there's always a wonderful moment when no one asks a question and I can think I'm going to scrabble out, but it won't work. Doug, do you want to just take a question from the floor now while people are waiting? If anyone wants to abuse me, this is the moment to start. The lady down here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is to be done on the issue of Ukraine? And I also want to say that you are such a valued resource that I fear for your safety.
Thank you. I'll just repeat the question. This lady says that she heard me on Democracy Now this morning, which is so long ago I can't remember anything I said on it. But that most of you here, she says, would have known the information that Noam Chomsky and I were saying on that program. I do know Noam Chomsky quite well, of course. Indeed, I'll be speaking with him in Boston on Sunday. But what can you do about the situation of the press? And this lady was also kind enough to say she fears for my safety. I don't, actually. I'm flying too fast and through too many countries to think about it. But I don't think you should. The people you should worry about are the Iraqis who are living in a hell at the moment, in a hell disaster, to use to use Winston Churchill's phrase about Palestine in 47, it's a hell disaster, from the border of Kurdistan right down to Basra. What can you do at the press? You know, I don't know. I think there's a line I mustn't cross. The big problem I have at the moment are the number of people, letter writers, more than half of them from the United States, because you use my hated internet, which I don't use, and I don't use email. And more than half of these letters come from the US, which is, what do we do when we vote for our congressman and congresswoman and they go off to the hill and what they say doesn't represent anything I believe? We have exactly the same problem in Britain, where people more and more are writing to me, you know, just educated, middle-aged people who happen to read my paper, and I'm sure they write the same letters to The Guardian and they write to my editor saying, I vote for my MP, he goes to the House of Commons, and he doesn't say what I believe in, and he doesn't stop illegal wars. And I don't know what you do. The moment I say to you, demonstrate on the streets, you know, stand outside your congressman's home, I've become a politician and I'm not. I can tell you what's happening in Iraq. What you do about it is what you've got to decide to do. And I can't tell you. And I can't tell you in this country. I'm not a citizen of the United States, which is quite merciful when you're in the Middle East, I can tell you. but I don't know what you can do. Here we start some questions from people here. I'm going to ask who actually wrote these so that we can see the people. Could you explain how AIPAC has become what it is? It must have been accepted as an ally to US policymakers. Who wrote that one? Any hand up there? Can't see it. Anybody around? Okay, got it. Right, yes. Look, I'm going to come at this question from a different angle. You know, AIPAC works hard. The Israeli lobby works very hard. And the Arab lobby does not work so hard. I think it's getting much improved in the way in which it is trying to get a point of view across. But of course, because of the various dictatorships which run the Middle East, our dictatorships, of course, by and large, there is not an Arab lobby which can compete in any level playing field, to use the old journalistic cliche, in terms of information. Clearly, you know, this alliance between Israeli lobby groups and the Christian fundamentalists and Israel's supporters, quote unquote, because some of them I think do not do Israel a great deal of credit. Clearly, this is a very strange alliance. not least because the Christian fundamentalists, as we know, believe that at the day of the at the day of Armageddon, the Jews are either going to have to convert to Christianity or will be destroyed. I remember more than half, on average, the lectures I give in the United States are actually organized by Jewish Americans. And I remember one extraordinary moment. My God, I'm not going to get through that lot. I remember one extraordinary moment, thank you, Dave, when I was in Berkeley, where the Christian fundamentalists were protesting outside the lecture I was going to give with the Israeli flag, shouting, "We thought the Holocaust was over." And the guy who was arranging it, who was Jewish American, Jeffrey and I are good friends, I said, "Jeffrey, I'm holding the lecture, as you know today. It's in a converted church. I'm going to take you inside and show you the Stations of the Cross because you may need to know this if these guys win." And Jeffrey said, "I've already been there, Bob. I've worked this out." But, you know, it seems to work, this alliance. And the worst thing is it does shut people up. You know, in Britain, if someone accuses... It's still there as a threat, but if someone accuses me of anti-Semitism and they put a name to the letter, I write back threatening them with legal action. I am not a racist. I will not have it said. It is not true. When I gave a talk to up to 600 members of the British Jewish community in Nottingham two years ago, I said, and it was a very good audience, I said to them, you know, if you falsely accuse decent people who criticize Israel of anti-Semitism, you will make anti-Semitism respectable. And that is the danger. I said, there are real anti-Semites out there, and I'm on your side against them. But don't use that word, that racist, slanderous word against journalists who are trying to do their job in the Middle East. And the problem is that when you use that word against journalists in the United States, it has a devastating effect. And it goes right down the line. I can remember a Boston Globe correspondent friend of mine in Cairo more than 5-6 years ago. He was just leaving the Middle East after the usual 3-year period, just long enough 3 years to get you to begin to have contacts and understand the region. Then you're sent to Peking, right, or Moscow. And he said to me, "Oh, I won't be sorry to leave." I said, "Why? What is it?" He said, "Well," he said, "the pressures we come under." He said, "You know, my editor called me up the other day and asked me to stop calling it the right-wing Likud government, because readers objected to the phrase right-wing." And I said, "So what'd you do?" He said, "Oh, I stopped using right-wing." So the Likud government was like the Labour government in Britain or any other government. And this is the sort of thing, and I've talked before in this room about the way in which so many journalists, anxious to avoid controversy, refer to the occupied territories as the disputed territories, which, of course, is originally what Colin Powell told his diplomats to do after Oslo. It is the way in which they will refer to colonies as settlements, as neighborhoods, or as outposts. Or the wall, I notice, has become a fence, like the Berlin fence, as it would have been called had it been built by the Israelis, even though it's twice as high. Or the security barrier, as the Lebanese-occupied zone used to be called the security zone, even though it was the most insecure place in the Middle East. And this is the same thing. I'm afraid it's journalism that, you know, it becomes a habit. You have children who have to be put through school, a mortgage to pay on your real estate, your house. Why become a controversial journalist by calling a spade, or a wall, or a colony? And so that's how it happens. You know, I think the whole AIPAC thing, although I'm actually writing a big piece in our paper about it next week, following, of course, the famous two-authored report, I think it's very much overrated. I think that journalists don't need these pressures through lobby groups to write the way they do. They do it through habit, and they do it because too many, I fear, are treating journalism as if it's a job like working in a bank or a real estate office or driving a bus. And it's not. It should be. And I'm not trying to associate journalism with medicine, but it should be a kind of vocation. If we're going to risk our lives for it, and many of us do, my goodness, we better tell the truth. Because if we're not going to, what the hell are we risking our lives for? You're not going to get this lot. Okay. Share the impressions you gained of Osama bin Laden after meeting him face to face. Impressions not revealed by the mainstream media. Who sent me this knuckle duster? Anybody around here? Yes, there we are. I'm going to have to live with this guy for the rest of my life because I met him 3 times. I should tell you that bin Laden is the man who gave me the most obscene blessing I could wish for when, just before the last US presidential election, he announced that Robert Fisk was a neutral reporter and said that if the White House wanted to know what Al-Qaeda thought, they could ask Robert Fisk. Thank you, Osama, I said to myself when I heard this, you know, by name, for God's sakes. I will not be so kind about him. He always came across as a most ruthless person. The first time I met him, I wanted to talk to him about what it was like to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. He thought I was going to do the terrorism bit, which I did a little bit later on, but I wanted to ask about the Soviets. And he talked about what it was like to be in combat against the Russian army, which had clearly influenced him a lot. He described at one point how a mortar shell fired by the Russians in Nangarhar province, which is the capital of Jalalabad, had fallen at his feet. And he said he'd waited for it to explode with a feeling of sakina, of complete calmness. And this was obviously a religious experience for him. Unfortunately, as many of us would say, it didn't explode. But the point was that this clearly was an experience that influenced him. As I went to see him again and then again, he changed, of course, as we all do, as the years go by. I thought he became vainer. He was a person completely without self-doubt, a quality he shares with your own president, of course. And he talked about good and evil all the time, which is another quality that will be familiar to you. He was perhaps the only Arab figure I've ever interviewed who, instead of blurting out the first thing that came into his mind when you asked him a question, for fear, of course, that silence makes you look stupid, he would sit for up to a minute cleaning his teeth with a piece of wood while he thought about the reply, and then would give it in complete sentences, while the armed Al-Qaeda men round me sat with the expression of men listening to a messiah. I didn't like his hold over them and the way he kept saying, one of our brothers had a dream. The most frightening moment came for me in the third time I met him when he said he entered the tent. I was waiting for him in. There were a lot of Al-Qaeda people there. And after sitting down, he said, Mr. Robert, one of our brothers had a dream that you came to us on horseback dressed as an imam in a black turban and a long robe. Yeah. And I realized at once, there's a whole book to be written about the dreamology of Wahhabis. You remember the Prophet Muhammad was in a kind of trance when he received the message from God. Dreams are very important. Bin Laden speaks constantly of dreams and their meaning, that they have a direct meaning, which we don't believe. We just think it's the brain ticking over while we're asleep if we're not a Wahhabi. But he did have this belief, and it was quite clear to me at the time that he was sniffing to see if there was a recruit. How nice to have an Englishman to fly an aeroplane, for example. Yeah, it's not funny, though. I was terrified by it. And I heard myself replying before I thought what the reply should be, but I got it right. I said, Mr. Bin Laden, I am not a Muslim. I am just a journalist, and my job is to tell the truth, full stop. And I waited, and he said, and you can imagine the Al-Qaeda people. Yeah. And he then said to me, ah, Mr. Robert, this means it's the same as being a good Muslim. Whew. So I was okay. That gives you an idea of what it's like to sit opposite bin Laden. Let me try and look at some other. Yes, 100%, I believe it. Let me have a look at this one. Too ill-written to read. Here in the US, the media has been using video news releases where corporations and their government use pieces for television airings, thus being passed off as legit news stories, when in reality it is propaganda. Does the same occur in England? I haven't actually seen this, because one of the merciful things about living in the Middle East is I don't have to watch American television. But I do have to watch Arab television, which is almost as bad. And if you ever want to watch Saudi television, whose news items, up to 20 minutes, is one prince meeting another prince, to the music of Mozart and Handel, you will understand how wonderful it is to turn to CNN and Fox News occasionally. The same total atmosphere of unreality persists. No, I think we're a bit stricter in Britain about how we use news clips. What we do in Britain, which I still object to, is we have acted reenactments, and it usually says in the bottom left, reenactment. But for what? You know, what's the point of having a documentary when you're going to have a bunch of actors in it? Then you call it feature film. I'd like to be a scriptwriter on a movie one day. Let me have a look through here. This is coming out of the blue, and you can tell I can't even censor it. Since we broke it, shouldn't our troops stay in Iraq to try to fix it? Yeah. This is the Lloyd George system again, isn't it? Look, every time you invade someone else's country, it's very difficult to leave without leaving with your tail between your legs. And eventually, America will need the help of Syria and Iran to get out. And they'll get that help. And the Syrians already believe, this is my understanding, that they will not be hoisted up on the hook of culpability for the murder of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri on the 14th of February last year if they'll give a little bit more help to the Americans in their problems in Iraq. And you may have noticed the silence that has descended across that inquiry since the new German prosecutor took over from Detlef Melis, the German prosecutor, who I thought was doing a very thorough, dangerously thorough job. Look, I don't know what you can say. Noam Chomsky made this point this morning that occupying armies don't have rights, they have responsibilities, which is true, but we don't care about Iraqis. In fact, I don't think we care about Arabs in general. You know, I've said this before, maybe in this room, that I think Arabs would like some of our democracy. They'd like some of our packages, our boxes of human rights off our Western supermarket shelves. But I think they also want another kind of freedom, and that is freedom from us. And we are not planning to give them that freedom. I looked up, actually, the issue of justice, which is what they asked for even more. You can't build democracy on sand. You have to build it on justice. And we all know the issues of injustice in the Middle East. And I went through my files, since I don't use Google, since I don't use the internet, all my papers, and I went through to find any mention by Bush and Blair of the word justice. And the only reference I could find was a military operation called Operation Infinite Justice, which is not what the Arabs had in mind. So I think that until you start looking at it through the glass darkly from Baghdad, instead of looking at it from New York, Washington, London, Paris, or wherever, you won't find the answer to the question. Do we have a responsibility to stay in a country we illegally invaded? And who is this responsibility for? To cover the tracks of presidents and prime ministers who lied to us, or to help the Iraqis whom we love so much that we do not even categorize and detail how many of them die every day? Remember how George Bush said, when he at last came clean that quite a few thousand Iraqis had died, that even then the figure was ridiculous. He said there were 30,000 more or less who had died. More or less. Imagine if he'd said, well, 2,000 American soldiers had died, more or less. He wouldn't have said that, would he? You wouldn't let him get away with anything like that. But he could say it about Iraqis, more or less, like an extra 1,000, an extra 10,000. I think that when we don't care about these people, we have no business being there. And I tell you this, I talked to a lot of American and British soldiers in Iraq. Generals and above, you can forget. They're looking after their careers. But colonels and below will tell you what I'm telling you. Not all of them. Not all of them. But most of them will tell you the project is over. It's finished. It's a disaster. And they know it. And they come home here, and some of them turn up in my lectures in San Diego not so long ago and tell me the same thing afterwards. Some of them come in uniform, by the way. You know, your soldiers, most of you are Americans, your soldiers know this. And I've come across only one in the last 3 years who's come up to me after I've given a lecture and told me I was wrong. He really did believe I was wrong, by the way. He really believed it could work, and I don't think it can. It's over in Iraq. It's finished. The question is, how much worse does it get before someone tells you we got it wrong? And I don't know the answer to that. Why hasn't the Turkish government not been able to admit to the Armenian massacres as a last gasp of the Ottoman regime with nothing to do with the modern Turkish state? Oh, goodness me. Who asked that one? I bet they were Armenian. Any hand up as responsible for this question? Oh, there we go, up there. Right, well, it's about Turkish nationalism. I don't know how to answer this, because, you know, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, founder of the Turkish nation, spoke with great venom about those young Turks who carried out the mass murder of Armenians. But that section of the Turkish parliamentary record is also not part of the national historical narrative of Turkey. I believe that the Turkish government must acknowledge what the Turkish Ottomans did to the Armenians before they are permitted to join the European Union. And I cannot understand why your present president, who promised prior to his first election that he would acknowledge the genocide of the Armenians, will now only talk of it as the tragedy of the Armenians. It wasn't a tragedy any more than September 11th, 2000 was a tragedy. It was an international crime against humanity, and that's what we should acknowledge it to be. In fairness, I have to say that more and more Turks are coming to the view, especially the middle classes, that I'm putting to you. I remember at the time of the Turkish earthquakes in 1999, the same earthquake for which that very fine Armenian said he prayed for the victims, I remember how I turned up in the area of Istanbul that had first been, you know, the houses had come down, and I found this man wandering around with his daughter who spoke good English. I had my old Turkish press pass from Cyprus. I'm Basim, I could get in. And I said to him, "What are you?" And he said, "Well, you won't believe it." He said, "I'm Turkey's top volcanologist and top earthquake expert, and the government won't even pay my taxi fare to go and see what's happened." So I said, "You're working for The Independent from today." Indeed he was. And when we spoke with his family later, I took them all out to dinner with some of his scientific friends. We all talked quite openly and freely about the Armenian genocide and where it happened and what happened, and we all knew. And they all thought it was ridiculous that their government was not acknowledging it. So the door is open if we walk through it and if we encourage Turks to walk through it. But again, I think we, as non-Armenians like me and those of you who are Armenians, I think we have to try and acknowledge the courage of those few Turks who tried to save Armenian lives, because then we can say, do you not want to acknowledge the courage of your own people at this terrible moment of history? And I think the Turks will find it very hard to say that those brave men and women who sheltered Armenians were traitors. I don't think they can say that. I don't think they will. No. It's too long an answer, and I'm not going to waste your time with it at the moment. Most ironic that you project the Ottoman conquerors as victims, as you only mention the Armenians as victims. How about the 1.5 million Greeks and 800,000 Assyrians? Yes, absolutely. We do, of course, concentrate on the Armenians, and I know that many tens of thousands of Muslims were killed in European Ottoman Empire by, indeed, us, the West, prior to the First World War. I think, however, that the Armenian genocide is important because it was the clear starting construct of the Jewish Holocaust later in the same century. They used railway trains. I went in Syria to caves wherein Armenians were stuffed and then smoke from bonfires was blown in to suffocate them, the very first primitive gas chambers. I think that, indeed, if you look at Vadrian and other Armenian academic work on the Armenian genocide, which we in our paper, by the way, call the Armenian Holocaust with a capital H, and that's how it appears in The Independent, as does, of course, the Jewish Holocaust with a capital H. Their discourse has, and their inquiries have discovered that German junior officers who were training the Ottoman army in 1915 on behalf of the Kaiser, of course, because of the alliance with the Ottoman Empire, and who witnessed and saw the system of mass murder, later pop up in the Wehrmacht in Russia doing exactly the same to the Jews of Eastern Europe. So there is a clear, important historical linkage between the Armenian genocide and the mass murder of the Jews, of 6 million Jews in the Second World War. That, I think, is what makes the Armenians such an important crime against humanity. What I am amazed at is the number of Israeli officials who will not acknowledge that the Armenian massacres were a genocide, and that includes Shimon Peres. In all fairness, Israel Chani, who is speaking in America very shortly, who is the leading Israeli scholar on genocide, wrote very bitterly to Shimon Peres when he heard that he denied the Armenians had a genocide, saying that it was not a decent or moral thing to do, and that clearly the Armenian massacres did represent a genocide, which, of course, they did. And indeed, in Chani's Encyclopedia of Genocide, the Armenians have a very prominent position. Let me just have a quick look through one or two more, and then I'm going to either collapse or drink too much water. When most government officials will only provide information off the record, how can we avoid so many quotes and facts from so-called authorities? I pretty much answered that. You can't believe them. You simply can't. I mean, I noticed only the other day another story popped up. It's actually in French, but I'll translate it for you. Tehran is ready to utilize terrorism in case of an American attack. And according to the newspaper, which is the Washington Post, the information comes from Responsable Américain des Services de Renseignement Anonyme, anonymous American intelligence officials. There they go again, you see. What do you do about them? I suppose you can start reading the Washington Post and the New York Times. I always say that the New York Times should be renamed American Officials Say. And you don't need reporters anymore. I've just seen one question I'm definitely not going to answer. Let me try one more. How can you be so sure the Mossad had nothing to do with 9/11 and Osama bin Laden did? Oh, I'm glad this is the last question I'm going to answer. I have an absolute clear conviction from knowing bin Laden pretty well and knowing lots of his people that he was behind it. Don't ask me why there is so much secrecy around 9/11. There are lots of questions we all need to know the answers to, but I don't think Mossad was behind it. I have to tell you that I did, not long ago, pick up a South Korean taxi driver on the East River who told me that he noticed that North Korean immigrants who had escaped were not close to the World Trade Center on September the 11th, 2001. Let that be my reply. Thank you, Doug.
This MP3 was made available online by the New York Sound Posse at newyorksoundposse.com.